Okay.
So let's turn to Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 16 through 19 to kind of make a setting here. Carol, would you read that, please? 16 through 19. Okay, this is quite a statement. He talks about his inward parts trembling. Evidently, there's something. He's afraid. His lips are quivering, and he's trembling. He's in his place trembling, and yet he knows he must wait for whatever is to come. So, to get a setting for what this is, let's go back to Habakkuk chapter 1, 1 through 17. This is a dialogue, a conversation, if you will, between Habakkuk and God. And so if anybody would like to share what they came up with on who's speaking, and divide up the verses and who's speaking when. Volunteers? Okay, 1 through 4, or 2 through 4, actually, is Habakkuk. He's talking to God. He's crying to God for help, and yet he says God won't hear. He tells him all the violence that's going on, but you won't save us. And why do you make me see all of this? And look on this wickedness and the destruction and the violence. And he says the law is ignored and justice is never upheld. The wicked surround the righteous. And justice, he feels like, just, it comes out a mess. It's not right. When we pray, do we ever think of talking to God like this? If we're in a mess, and things are a mess, the nation's a mess, the church is a mess, our life is a mess, do we ever go to God and just lay out how we feel and kind of cry to God for help? That's what he's doing here. He says, how long will I call for help? And you will not hear. And we may feel that God's not listening. But if we think of the book of Habakkuk, God's not going to have a conversation back with us. But he does with Habakkuk. So, God does hear. God does listen. Verse 5 through 11, God is answering Habakkuk back. And he tells him, look, be amazed, in other words. Something is going to happen. And it's going to happen in your days. You're going to see this, Habakkuk. That's what he's telling Habakkuk. You're going to see this. And he says, you wouldn't believe it if I tell you. And then he does proceed to go on to tell him what's going to happen. He tells him that the Chaldeans are coming, and they're a horrible people. And they're just going to march right through, and they're going to take everything that's not theirs. And they're to be feared. This is a horrible thing that's going to happen here. They're going to, in verse 11, he says, they will sweep through like the wind and pass on. But they will be held guilty because they put their strength in their God, not in the God who was allowing them to do this. But Habakkuk gets an answer from God. But then Habakkuk has some more situations that he does not understand, and some answers that he wants. In verse 12 through 13, Habakkuk answers God again. And he tells God what a wonderful God he is. And he acknowledged that he was sending judgment, but he could not understand how God was sending them to judge, how the Chaldeans to judge Israel, because the Chaldeans were more wicked than Israel was. And how could he allow that? We see in verse 13 and 14 there are three whys. Why do you look with favor on those who deal treacherously? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they? Why have you made men like fish of the sea, like creeping things without a ruler over them? So he just feels like the Chaldeans are going to come in and just take over. And how can God approve this? And then he goes on down in verse 17, and he says, will they therefore empty their net and continually slay without sparing? I mean, Habakkuk, he's just bewildered here. How can God do this? And so, but in Margaret, read chapter 2, verse 1, and see Habakkuk's answer, how he answers God after this.
I will take my stand at the watchspot and station myself on the tower. And I look out to see what is going to say to me and what will answer concerning my complaint.
Okay, so how many of us would just say, okay, God, you're going to do this, so I'm just going to go stand at my guard post and I'm going to just stand and watch and I'll see and see what else you have to say to me. Do you think we would just, okay, I've been told that my nation is going to be wiped out, pretty much. We're going to be taken into captivity. A nation's coming in to take us. They're going to take our houses. They're going to take our lands. And he just says, okay, I'll stand on my guard post and I'll watch. How many of us would do that? I'd be screaming. No, it's not easy.
So,
yes, we would. God, you really don't mean this. We're going to fix this. We're going to help you. We're a lot of times in the business of helping God rather than listening to God. Same thing in the New Testament under our law. There are things we don't understand and things we don't appreciate. I'm sure Habakkuk did not appreciate being told what he was told. But there are things that we don't like. And so instead of saying, I can do this, I can accept this, I will accept this, and go on. But that's what he did. He said, okay. To me, this says, okay, I can do this. I'll just stand here and watch and see what happens. And later on, we'll see an attitude that to me portrays, I will do this. And that's what we're looking at, is how, and looking, the reason we're looking at these incidences are to try to help us see that no matter what we face, it's not nearly as bad as what a lot of people have faced. And I'm not saying that this nation won't face this again someday. Our nation won't face being taken over someday. Of course, what is the difference in our nation being taken over in their nation? None, exactly. But there was one caveat. What was it?
They viewed themselves as being, the chosen people.
And they were. They were the chosen people. God had promised them this land. He had promised them that they would live quiet and prosperous lives. But they saw it as God not keeping up his bargain. But what was the problem with that?
They forgot the not but.
That's right. They forgot the not but. They forgot if they don't do their part, God doesn't do his part. And they forget about that. And they also forget that God, there were blessings, but also what were their
curses.
There were blessings and there were curses. And they were more than willing to accept the blessings, but not do what God told them to do and not want the curses and cannot understand why they're being cursed. And that's how we get sometimes. We forget the not but. We forget that God promises that he will take care of us, but it may not always be in the way we want. It may not always be what we like. But they saw that they had specific promises that they wanted, and they wanted them kept. Okay, and then starting in verse 2, going down through verse 20, God has another thing that he has some more he has to say. He's telling them record the vision. He's telling them, you write all this down. You leave this for time. For the vision is not yet at the appointed time, but it's coming. And then he starts talking about, in verse 4, the proud one. And who would the proud one be?
The Chaldeans.
He's going to explain to him that yes, the Chaldeans are coming, and it looks like they're getting off scot-free, but they're not. We go down, and when we get to verse 9 through 15, there are three woes. He says, woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to put his nest on high, to be delivered from the hand of calamity. He talks about he's delivered. He's devised his own way. He's cutting off many people. He's sinning against himself. And then in verse 12, he says, woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and founds a town with violence. Verse 14, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of God as the waters covers the sea. In other words, God sees all this. God knows what's going on, and God will take care of it. And then verse 15, woe to you who make your neighbors drink, who mix in your venom, even to make them drunk as they look on their nakedness. And down in verse 19, he says, woe to him who says to a piece of wood, awake, to a stone, a mute stone, arise. As if this is the one who's done all of this for you. And so he's saying, you've done all this, and you've done it. You know, sometimes God gives us a task to do, but we get extreme. You know, we talk about withdrawing from people. And then I think some people would just kill them if they thought they could get away with it, just be done with them. But that we have to follow God's plan, not go too little or too much. And the Chaldeans were doing way over what God really wanted them to do to this people, but they need to be punished, and God's using them. But who are they? Who are the Chaldeans getting all the glory for this?
Their idols.
Their idols. That's right. And God says in at the end of 19, behold, it's overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all inside of it. I forget what passage it is where it talks about they'll take a log and they'll make some of it for firewood, and they'll make a god out of the other. And how can you believe in this God that you made half of it for firewood and half of it for a god? But that's what these people did. And then it's interesting, and I'm not sure. I can't make up my mind, and I didn't get a chance to talk to Steve, so I'll just throw it out there. Verse 20 says, but the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. I don't know if that is Habakkuk's conclusion, or if that's God's conclusion to the end of the matter with the Chaldeans. So y'all can study that for yourself and decide. And whatever it is, basically what I get out of this, whoever's saying it, is God is in control. Be quiet and listen. And we don't always like that. Who do we like to be in control? Us. We want to be in control. We want to feel like we're fulfilling our destiny. We're in control, and we can make our destiny whatever we want it to be. In some ways, that's true, but spiritually, it's not. If we want to go to heaven, you may be in control of your destiny here and the money you make and all that. But whatever we do with all of that, we have to do it in God's. There's some parameters God has set for us, and we have to live within that if we want the great prize of heaven in the end. Any questions or comments so far? Okay. Anybody hear somebody say something? Okay. In Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 1 through 15, in verse 3 and 4, he praises God's power. He praises God. He just praises. He praised God. So then in verse 5 through 15, he praises the power of God. And so he talks about all the things that the rivers and the earth and everything that God has made and controls. And so I guess he's kind of psyching himself up for verse 16 through 19, because it's quite a mouthful, as Carol read. Even though he was afraid, he was quivering, he just couldn't imagine what was about to happen. And then in verse 17, the three those are pretty interesting. Though the fig tree should not blossom, the olive should not yield, and the olive tree should not yield, and there's no flocks. They've all been cut off. What does that say about the condition of life that he knew was about to happen? These people are coming to invade us, and then all these things are going to happen. There's no way to live. There's no sustenance. There's no food. They get their food from the fields, and he says, and the fields produce no food. And olive was very important to them because of the many things they did for it, and part of it was their worship to God. They used these things, all of these things, in their worship to God. There's not going to be any. There's no calves to bring to offer or anything. But mainly, there's not going to be any food. And then verse 18 was, to me, 18 and 19 to me shows I will. No matter what's coming, I will. He says, I will exult in the Lord. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength. He has made my feet like hinds' feet and makes me walk on my high places. That's a mouthful when you know what's happening. If we knew this nation was about to be crushed, our world is about to be turned upside down, we have no prophet to come tell us. They've had prophet after prophet after prophet to come and warn them. Habakkuk's not the first prophet to get a prophecy about all of this, and yet they would not listen. And so even though we don't have a prophet, can we just say, I don't know what's happening in this nation, I don't know what's happening in this world, but I know who's in control. God is. And I'm going to glorify Him. I'm going to rejoice that my salvation is secure. That's quite a triumphant statement to make for somebody who's facing such trials and such difficulties. And is there anything else that anyone would like to discuss that I missed? I know I skipped over a lot of this, just kind of trying to summarize, and I'm not always good at that. Nobody? Okay. Now we're going to look at some examples of people who showed both attitudes that we could summarize through their life. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 39. This is about Joseph, and where is Joseph and why? Would that make you shake your faith a little bit in this God that you've been taught about all your life? Your own brothers. You know, it's bad enough to be sold into slavery. But when it's your own brothers who are doing it, the people who should be protecting and taking care of you. I know there's a sibling rivalry and all that kind of thing, but this is pretty extreme. So he's been sold, and now he's in Egypt, and Potiphar has pretty much bought him. He's the chief captain and bodyguard, the captain of the bodyguard to Pharaoh. And yes, he did, but he doesn't know that. Does anybody have any idea about what age he is at this time? He was in his teenage years. I don't have it written. I think it was 17 or 18. And we know that by the time frame. Stephen's good at all the dates. And I usually have him written in my Bible because he teaches it in class. And I write it down, but I missed that one somehow. But he's very young. And now he's been sold into slavery. Even if he was 19 or 20, that's still young to be torn away from your family. And by your brothers, and you wonder, why didn't daddy come at least find me, look after me, see what happened to me? Of course, he has no idea that his father thinks he's dead.
Do you think he's holding on to his dream?
It could be. God has sent him some pretty powerful dreams. And, but God talked to Solomon, and he didn't hang on to what God told him. So, sometimes people lose sight of you know, and even Saul, you know, God promised him that he would make of him a great nation, and if he would just do what God told him, but he didn't hang on either. So, but that may have been in his mind. It could have been. It could have been the thing that he held on to. We're never really told, but he goes through quite a trying time in all of this. But before we read verse 9, in verse 2 and in verse 3, and farther on down in the chapter 21 and 23, what is the recurring phrase?
The Lord was with him.
That's right. The Lord was with him. Joseph had some sort of faith for God to be with him and strengthen him in this way. But still, he had to hold on to that faith. God did not make him have that faith. And so, let's read verse chapter 39. Read verse 9. We're looking at what phrase in this verse shows that he had the I can attitude. Susan, would you read that, please?
There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God?
So what is the phrase here that you would, that to you shows, and maybe I missed this, but to me that's what it says, that has this attitude, I can. How can I do this great evil and sin against God? It's not just an evil against Potiphar. That would have been a pretty great evil. Here Potiphar had bought him out of the prison and given him a good life. Now he's pretty much on easy street. He's got he lives in a nice house. He goes on to say that what he says here, that there's no one greater in this house than I, and he's withheld nothing from me. So whatever Joseph wanted or needed, Joseph had. And so that was a pretty good position to be in. But what did he do to show that he had the I will commitment? Elizabeth, read verse 12.
She caught him by his garment, saying, "Why with me?" And he left his garment in her hand and said, and went outside.
So what did he do?
He didn't give in to her. He left.
That's right. He left. And do you think he thought this was just going to be the end of it? If this kind of woman is after you, I doubt that she's just going to tell her husband nothing, especially if he left the garment in his hand. He didn't even go back to get his garment. She took it off of him, and I'm sure he could have overpowered her and got his garment back, but he didn't. He just left it. He wanted out of there. And what is he doing here? He's fleeing temptation. I don't know if he was tempted to be with her or not. She may have been a beautiful woman. She may have been desirable. But he knew not to even stay there, not to even go back to get his garment. Get out of there. That is where the danger is. Flee. What lesson is that for us today?
Do the same.
Do the same. If you're tempted for something, get out of there. There are men who know that there is a woman at work who is a big temptation to them. And instead of saying, "I'll quit this job, I'm leaving. My soul is worth more than all the money that I can make on this job." But they don't. They continue to work there. Maybe it's his boss. Maybe it's just somebody in the office. And they're still friends. And so many times that is how affairs happen. We don't flee. We don't run away from. People who want to be wealthy and rich, instead, they hear it's one big deal after the next. They're always chasing that rather than fleeing that temptation. I knew a man once that every time you saw him, we didn't see him but every few years, but it was always the next big scheme he was going to do to get rich. He was just this close. That one, well, what happened to the last one? Well, that one didn't work out, but this is going to be the one. He lost his family. He and his wife never divorced, but he moved to another town, and she refused to go with him because she knew what was going to happen. He wound up buying a house, but the only way he could afford it was people paid him to live there. He kind of ran a boarding house, and that's basically what he was doing, was running a boarding house. And he continued, you'd talk to him on the phone. "Oh, yeah, I'm working on this big deal." And you just think how sad. Instead of him going back to his wife, they had a beautiful home. Beautiful home that she lived in. But she was working, and she knew she had to work. I'm not saying she did the right thing. If her husband wanted to go, even if he was like that, I would feel that my obligation is to go with him. She was, and they were Christians. I guess. You know, that's a loose term. But as far as I know, they went to church faithfully to the day they died, both of them. But, in fact, she wound up, her children, she got so ill, her children finally went and got her and moved them to where they were, put her in a nursing home, and she died in a nursing home by herself. With the children being what comfort they can. But how many of us are willing to be like Joseph? I'm fleeing out of here. This is going to cost me my soul. And I'm not saying where either one of those people went. They're both dead now, and that's between them and God. But what our attitude needs to be is, this is going to cost me my soul. And that's basically what he's saying. How can I do this great evil and sin against God? That's what God is something that's going to cost us our soul. And he didn't want any part of it. So if we could just have these two attitudes, I can and I will, no matter what it costs me, I'm going to serve God. And that's a mouthful. But we can, with God's help. And I don't know if Joseph knew God was helping him or not. But, and we don't go on to read that, the rest of it, but then he winds up back in prison, and the whole thing about the baker and the butler, and he gets to go stand before Pharaoh and becomes the second in the whole Egypt to Pharaoh. And so God does continue to bless him even after he does what he does. He was blessed by God.
And at the end, he knew what God did.
Yes, he did. In the end, he did. And that is when I think he really remembered the things when his brothers are bowing down before him. Mm-hmm. If he hadn't thought about those dreams before, which he probably did, but he really thinks about them now because they're coming true. And yet, those dreams are part of what got him thrown into the pit. We wonder about the providence of God. Sometimes we see troubles in our life, but we don't realize God, we have to go through those troubles to get to where God really wants us to be. And sometimes that's heaven. Okay. Any other questions or comments on Joseph? Okay. We have time to do Daniel. Let's look at Daniel chapter 1. We looked at Daniel already at the end of his life and saw that he continued to have the I will. But I think in Daniel chapter 1, we can see the I can part that Daniel had from a very young age. And again, we don't know how old Daniel was exactly, but what would have been in the beginning, the middle, or the end of his life?
It would be like when he was a teenager.
So pretty much at the beginning, to me. I mean, not baby beginning, but the beginning of his adult life. And making his own decisions. I forget who read last. Nadine, would you read verse 8, please, of Daniel chapter 1?
But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or the wine which he brings. So he sought permission from the commanders of the officials that he might not defile himself.
Okay. So what phrase here shows that the I can attitude? And this could go either way, but anyway. He made up his mind. And I know that's part of the will also, but we have to me, he's making up his mind. I can do this. I don't have to, they're wanting to feed him all this food and all that, but he made up his mind that he didn't want to do that. He knew that that was displeasing to God. And it's interesting that in verse 9, it says, now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander and of the officials. Would Daniel have had this kind of compassion from the commander and the officials had he not took a stand and made up his mind? No, this is not what I want to do. And what did he do that shows? And this was kind of a little to me. It could have gone either way. See what y'all came up with. What did he do that shows that he had the I will determination?
That's what he sought permission.
Right. That's what I got out of it. I'm not going to do this. But he didn't just go in rebellious. He asked for permission. He said, I don't know. My guess is if they'd have said no, he still wouldn't have done it. I don't know that, but with the rest, at the end of his life, that's the way it was. And also, there are three other people here in verse 11 that are included in this incident. And who are they? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So he wanted to be sure. They had this same. So these four young men are remarkable to be as young as they are, but to have this great faith. They asked to be tested for 10 days, and they were only going to eat, if I understand the scriptures right, they're only going to eat vegetables and drink water. And my question in my mind was, why couldn't they eat the meat? Because God allowed them to eat meat, but would the meat have been prepared correctly? That would have been a problem. They could not eat the meat with the blood. The blood had to be drained out of the meat. And I don't know if the Chaldeans did that. Probably not. We don't today. I don't guess. I'm not a butcher, so I don't know. Of course, we don't have that law today. But that would be my answer if someone says, well, why is he only eating vegetables? Is he didn't know how the meat would be prepared and whether or not that would be just as much sin as, you know, that would... Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do they hang it up and let all the blood drain out?
I don't know about that, but I know that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, but the part of the New Testament was they were still under the civil law, and that this was part of their civil law. So I don't know, but I don't go to the butcher shop and ask if they drained all the blood out of it. So, but anyway, that would be my answer to that. And then in verse 14 through 16, we see after they were tested, it came out great for them, didn't it? They were seemed to be smarter and better in better health than the ones who had been eating the king's choice food. So, again, God blesses them and is with them. Verse 17, it says God gave them knowledge and intelligence. So God was with them where he evidently was not with the others he was with these. Because these are the four that seem to rise in the kingdom, in the Chaldean kingdom, but yet God had a plan for them and work for them to do. And of course, Daniel became a great prophet and left us a book to read. What could have been the outcome if the overseer had refused to allow Daniel to do as he had requested? Do we have any idea? Death? Prison? At least prison. That would be the least of it. Or banished to some horrible task that they would not have wanted to do.
Put back out with the people that were captive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they've got it pretty good. You know, they're not too many of these captives came and went to what we would consider college. You know, they were educated in their languages and the things that they needed to do. And Daniel rose pretty high in the kingdom at one point with Nebuchadnezzar, and he was still a counselor and brought in by the various other kings. So these are people that we can look at and say, yes. We're not going to do Mary because we've got about 2 minutes left, and so we're not going to do Mary today. But we'll do Mary, and we will start into the... I passed out the new lesson today, and so we will start working on that. I have no idea how long these... I'm hoping that we're finished up no later than the Christmas break, so that... And Linda will start the new class in...